Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next matter on our case for oral argument is Alan Joseph Zakrashek versus State of Minnesota. I know I probably didn't get that pronunciation right. I didn't do very well in the first case either, and I apologize to both parties. In any event, we are here for oral argument. We're proceeding by Zoom, but the same rules will apply as would apply in our courtroom. You will each have 15 minutes for your arguments. Mr. Edwards, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And it's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent because we are making an audio recording of the session, and that is the only recording that is permitted. So with that, Mr. Edwards, you may proceed with your argument on behalf of the appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Barry Edwards. I'm with the Keller Law Offices, and I represent Alan Zakrashek. Not sure I did a much better job than the court with his name. I have asked Mr. Zakrashek several times, and he has patiently told me how to say his name, and I hope that I didn't butcher it. What we have here in Mr. Zakrashek is a gentleman who, like so many of our clients, like so many defendants, doesn't know legal jargon, doesn't know legal procedure. He described himself as illiterate when it comes to matters of law, which was humble and I think appropriate. Mr. Zakrashek referred in his post-conviction hearing, he analogized to a mechanic, how he, as a mechanic, can rebuild an engine. I think he said he can rebuild a transmission. I, on the other hand, would be completely at the mercy of my mechanic when it came to that because I'm illiterate in those matters. I personally would analogize to a medical discussion. When my doctor informs me of my options, I'm not on constructive notice of what's in the medical literature. I rely on my doctor's opinion. Similarly, Mr. Zakrashek, in this case, had to rely on the opinion and the advice and the explanation of his trial counsel.
How do you square your argument with the district court's, the post-conviction court's credibility findings about this, about what your client says concerning interaction with trial counsel?
Inferring that the court, what I read the district court, the post-conviction court as saying, I don't think the district court questioned Mr. Zakrashek's credibility with regard to his communication with trial counsel. The district court, the post-conviction court simply said that he questioned the credibility of Mr. Zakrashek. Mr. Zakrashek said lots of things. I'm not exactly sure which things in particular.
Right. So if the district court was generally concerned that your client lacked credibility, how does your argument now on appeal about your client's reliance on the attorney square with that credibility decision?
And
Well,
if I may piggyback onto that question, just for the purpose of the question, the post-conviction court's finding 32 was the court does not find petitioner's testimony that his counsel had failed to explain his constitutional rights as set forth in the Rule 15 petition to be credible. So expressly rejected your client's testimony that his lawyer did not explain the petition to him.
had the post-conviction judge explained why he didn't find that to be credible, I'd have a little more to work with.
Well, so would
Instead,
we,
when
but
he
judge have to explain it? I mean, I agree you have a little
little more to work with if he does, but are you saying there's any error in not explaining it?
Yeah, I mean, he's the judge of credibility, and the
What
reason
legal
that
authority requires a judge in the circumstance to explain a credibility determination?
I can't give you a legal authority for that, but to make a blanket, when I'm here at the Court of Appeals, it's taking issue with that statement, then had he's so the post-conviction judge had the reason that we have the post-conviction hearings, the reason this court asks us in cases where there are factual disputes still open to have a post-conviction hearing before we have the appeal, before we do the appeal, is to establish a record. What the post-conviction court did here was cut the record off at the knees, basically, and say, I just don't believe him. What we
Well,
I mean, that's
actually,
not reason.
that's not exactly true. What the post-conviction court said is, same judge, he appeared in front of me at the plea hearing under oath, swore that his attorney had gone through the petition with him, and he understood everything. Now he's here under oath saying, my attorney never went through anything with me. So he's essentially asking the post-conviction judge to determine and to sanction a situation where he purportedly lied to the court under oath at the plea hearing, and the court should now accept that he's telling the truth at the post-conviction hearing. Why would anyone believe him? And why would we want to endorse that scenario? I mean, the district courts, the judicial system relies heavily on the administration of the oath and the notion that if you take the oath and you swear to tell the truth and you provide testimony, whether at a trial or in support of your guilty plea or regarding waivers, we should be able to assume you're telling the truth. If we do what your client's trying to do, which is open the door to people to come back into court and say, well, yeah, I know I was under oath, but I lied back there. I'm telling the truth now, it would be chaos. And in fact, we have case law that says when a defendant goes to the post-conviction court and makes statements that are inconsistent with the statements the defendant made at the plea hearing, the post-conviction court gets to make a credibility determination and we defer to it. So if we're to defer to the post-conviction court's credibility determination here, which is fully explained in terms of he's given inconsistent testimony under oath, where does that leave your argument that the post-conviction court erred in finding he had not established ineffective assistance of counsel?
The reason the court, the reason this court should look askance at the post-conviction court's credibility determination is that Mr. Zakharychuk at the post-conviction hearing explained. He explained why he said what he said then being at the plea hearing, and why he said a different thing at the post-conviction hearing.
So
He
if the
explained.
district court, if the district court would have found your client credible,
At the post-conviction hearing?
at the post-conviction hearing, it would seem a really difficult thing for us to toss that credibility determination aside. Likewise, it seems difficult for us to toss the credibility aside now, when it goes against your client. What, given the standard of review, on what basis would we say that the district court's credibility finding would is the result of the district court's clearly erroneous assessment of your client's credibility? What would be the, given that high burden, what would we look to and point to say, well, you know, we don't usually reverse credibility determinations, but in this case, here's why we do. What distinguishes this case from the myriad cases where we say we're not going to revisit credibility in the appeal?
Well, Your Honor, to be frank, I don't think we need to. I don't think we even need to go down the credibility path because
Well,
the
assume we do.
question.
Assume we think we do. What would we point to? You're not going to get out of it that easy. What would we do? What would we point to and say, well, here the district court, wow. And I will tell you, since I've been on the court, at least on one occasion, I have reversed the district court's credibility determination. But the facts were nothing like these. I'm just trying to think, what is it in these facts that would lead us to conclude, you know what, the district court, it's obvious to us the district court made a credibility mistake.
Well, I'm going to get out of it this way then. I'm going to simply concede that point because I don't think it addresses on a de novo standard. And the legal issue, the notice issue, the due process issue of the conditional release period is, I think, the issue that this court needs to reverse and
Counsel,
remand.
was that issue raised and determined in the post-conviction court? As I read the papers, the issue that was presented was solely ineffective assistance of counsel at the plea stage and at the sentencing stage. I don't see anything in the post-conviction court's order about the allegation that there was a violation of due process rights because conditional release term was imposed at sentencing.
I don't think we addressed that at the post-conviction hearing. I treated the post-conviction hearing as an ability, as an opportunity to establish a further record for this court. And we did that on the issues that I thought we needed to establish a further record on. The conditional release issue strikes me as a legal issue, which is why I said to Judge Ross, we're talking about a legal issue here where this court approaches it de novo.
Well, if it is an issue that's properly before us, why isn't the Rhodes case dispositive?
Because of Usselman?
And what does Usselman say?
Usselman, as I understand it, and of course, I will point out that it's brilliantly written. As I understand the Usselman opinion, it's distinguishing between an agreement, and I guess I should make a better record here. Usselman is Uselman.
And is that, I don't
And
see that cited in your brief.
no, I didn't cite it in my brief. I was studying it, frankly, yesterday. It's 8:31 Northwest 2nd, 690. And of course, Judge Ross wrote that opinion. The Usselman opinion distinguishes between an agreement and a petition. And in this case, it's clear from the plea transcript that the agreement, that what the parties
Let me, just because your time is short,
which
let's
is
say
why I
we
wanted to.
agree there was no discussion of conditional release term in the plea discussions. We agree it's not referenced in the plea petition. We might also agree that your client had no knowledge of this possibility at the time he pleaded guilty. Yet Rhodes says, even if those are the facts, the relevant inquiry is not what defendant knew at the time he was pleading guilty, but whether he had notice at the time of sentencing. And in Rhodes, the Supreme Court said, well, he didn't know when he pleaded guilty, but that's not the relevant inquiry. It was recommended in the PSI. He had the PSI. It was imposed at the sentencing hearing. He didn't object to the PSI recommendation for conditional release period. He didn't object to the sentencing hearing. Therefore, it's fair to assume that he understood that conditional release would be imposed because at that point in law and time, the statute had been in effect. And in Garcia, the Supreme Court had said these statutory conditional release terms are mandatory, non-waivable. So, for all those reasons, the Supreme Court seemed to conclude that it doesn't matter that it wasn't part of the plea negotiation. It doesn't matter that the defendant may not have known at the time of the plea, but if it's imposed at sentencing and defendant is aware that it's being imposed and defendant doesn't object, he then can't complain.
The again, to get back to the Usselman opinion, there's we have to extract whether it's a technical issue. Yeah, he heard it here and therefore knew of it, or a due process notice issue. There's a due process issue when he agreed to a contractual, the state made a contract with him. It was on the record at some point at 3 or 4 months before sentencing, and then on, and then we're assuming constructive notice because he should have known of the statute that says that the conditional release period is unwaivable. There was an agreement, a plea agreement that the parties reached that he was okay with, that turned on its heels at sentencing. And this gentleman, who doesn't know legal language, didn't even know that he was hearing something different. My time is up.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent, Mr. Welch.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Aaron Welch. I'm an assistant county attorney in St. Louis County. I represent the respondent in this case. In preparing for today's argument, I was struck. I reread the appellant's brief, and then I reread respondent's brief, and I wasn't sure we were talking about the same case. It got me a little nervous. I thought, well, you know, maybe I've just got this completely wrong. But I think that the issues of credibility that the determinations that were made by the post-conviction court is the door that has to be opened before we even get to anything else. On the record, appellant's made a tactical choice, which was, I'm going to limit the record at post-conviction as much as possible so that that's all the court has to make a decision on. And if the only thing I give them is this, I win. And the problem with that is if the court doesn't believe the only thing you give them, you don't have anything left. And that's a tactical choice. You can make that. I don't know if you can tell by looking at me, I'm not a very tall person. I'm pretty short. When I played Little League, at one point I thought, okay, I'm not big, I'm not strong, I'm not hitting the ball far. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get in my crouch really small. I'm going to make the strike zone about that big. And you know what happened? They just called strikes because that's silly. That's not going to work. And then if a nice juicy one comes right down the middle, I can't stand up, set, and swing in enough time to hit it out of the park. If I could even do such a thing, which I couldn't. So it's a tactic, but then you're stuck with it. And I think it makes it really tough to come back now and say, well, there's not a lot of record here for me to do much with. Well, you're right, there isn't. So I don't know, to get at what Judge Ross was saying earlier, I don't know that there is any, there's not even competing evidence that you could point to say that the post-conviction court's determinations on credibility were erroneous. There's just nothing to point to. It's just, well, but he said it, so believe it. And that's really all that's there. And I don't see what error this court can find to correct.
Counsel, in your estimation, is the due process argument properly before this court?
Well, the fact that it wasn't dealt with at all at the post-conviction hearing is a little problematic because there wasn't anything else to talk about. But I guess where I came down on it in my own mind was, even if it is appropriately before this court, Rhodes is directly on point, is controlling authority, and there's really nothing else to talk about.
What about what's the impact of the Usselman case?
I will be honest, I did not read the Usselman case. I didn't check that one out yesterday. I read the cases that were briefed, and I read the cases that I cited, but I'm afraid I can't intelligibly speak about the Usselman case and its implication. Assuming for the moment that this court opens these doors and that we get to what appellant argues in their brief, if we get to ineffective assistance, we get to Strickland, we get to all that. The second prong of Strickland is a hurdle, frankly, here that the appellant just can't get over. There's no reasonable probability that this case would have had a different outcome, but for the alleged errors of trial counsel. And the district, or excuse me, the post-conviction court makes that explicit in their findings, where let's see here. Number 29, given the severity of the actual offense, there was no arguable basis for the court to grant a downward durational legislative departure, and under the circumstances, would not have granted the request. And at post-conviction and in all of the proceedings up to this point, all the post-conviction proceedings up to this point, there hasn't been any evidence given to the court saying, like, well, if trial counsel had done a better job, they would have presented these arguments. And these are really good arguments. And so they did such a bad job, they didn't even bring these really good arguments for the post-conviction court to say, oh, yeah, maybe I would have changed my mind if I'd heard that. We don't have that yet. We still don't know. It's all conjecture. The entire post-conviction process on this is, well, if trial counsel had been a good lawyer, he would have magicked up a better disposition argument, and he didn't, and so we get a do-over. And I just there's a lot of maybes and guesses there, and not a lot of actual foundation for, frankly, the post-conviction court to make any decision based off, and therefore no error for this court to correct. Those are, frankly, the points I wanted to make sure I made. I have a lot of time left, so if the court has any questions for me, I'd be happy to do my best.
Just one fairly relevant question. Are you familiar with Eddie Gaedel, baseball player?
Was he the shortest player that ever played in the that got a walk in
Can I
four
have that
pitches?
one, Your Honor?
I'm not quite that short, but yeah, whatever. I'm no matter how much I work to hit a curveball, I'm not making the majors anytime soon. So thank you all very much.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Edwards, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
He played for the White Sox. And Mike or Bill Veeck, I don't remember which is the father and which is the son, was the owner of the team at the time, later owned the state, son owned the St. Paul Saints. Now that I've used up my time, I got 5 minutes and five bullet points. I'm troubled that the court said in the post-conviction order, it doesn't really matter if he had made an argument because I wasn't going to buy it anyway. The trial counsel admitted at sentencing, and I'm looking at my brief, page 15, which refers to the sentencing transcript, pages 3 and 4. After arguments about sentencing, he says, "Sorry, I have to interrupt. I have also, prosecutor and I have discussed, and we apparently agreed that I have the opportunity to argue for a downward departure at the time of sentencing." So what we have here is trial counsel, defense counsel is saying, Oh, evidently I said I would make this argument. So I guess I should try to make something up on the fly here. We've got a judge saying, it really doesn't matter if he had made the argument. Doesn't matter what the argument was. I wasn't going to buy it anyway.
What are you
At
telling
some
us
point,
the
Mr.
argument? Counsel, I don't see any argument in your brief addressing the prejudice factor. I mean, the brief set out the Strickland test. The second part is prejudice. Your brief only objects, addresses the first part, whether representation was objectively unreasonable. Now, the post-conviction court, as a sentencing judge, said there, I see no grounds for departure, that there aren't grounds for imposing a presumptive sentence within the parameters of the plea negotiation. What is the prejudice?
Well, I've taken looking at the post-conviction order, paragraph 28. Counsel cited paragraph 29, where the court says and counsel says in his responsive brief that I never. I think the point petitioner does not address this issue in his memorandum. That's from paragraph 28 of the order. I think what that's referring to is I didn't make a sentencing argument, which is what
Okay,
I hear the
why aren't
court
you
saying.
addressing prejudice here? I mean,
Okay,
where
I'll do
is
it right
what is
now.
the argument that that if a better sentencing departure argument had been made, the outcome would have been different?
I was
It
looking
seems to make
at.
that argument at the very least, you have to cite some law that would support it.
I was looking at the departure rates for CSC1s from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. Unfortunately, the statute changes so often, it's hard to get good data on the exact subdivision, but departure on the what it was numbered as at the time. But the departure rates on the CSC1s around this, what would have been this subdivision at that time, were between 25 and 30%, maybe even higher. And the Sentencing Guidelines Commission reports, if you look at the underlying data, the Excel spreadsheets, which is how I approach arguing sentencing, and you look at the rationale that to the judges who granted departures list as their reasons for the departures, some of those could well have been applicable with appropriate interviews of collateral sources, with appropriate establishment of the record. We had a pre-sentence. My clock is moving around on the screen. We had a pre-sentence. I'm sorry, a psychosexual evaluation that determined that Mr. Zacharyshyk is not a sexual predator, is not a child predator. Yeah, all these things could have been raised. So, just on the fly, with a minute in my time remaining, I made a better argument than counsel did at sentencing. But again, I'm troubled that the judge below said, well, it really doesn't matter how good the argument is. I wasn't going to listen to it, or I wasn't going to change my mind.
Well, I'm not
So,
sure he said I wasn't going to listen to it. He said, I don't see a basis for a departure.
hadn't been
Regardless of
argued.
what stat you cite, at the end of the day, a judge has discretion to decide whether there are substantial and compelling circumstances that, in the case of a downward durational departure, make the offense less serious than the same offense committed by others. And I mean, we. The sentencing judge who took the plea, who imposed the sentence, said, and who read the PSI, I don't see anything that would have enabled me to make that showing.
Well, there's no, I don't think there's such a thing as a CSC1 with good facts. So I think any CSC1, we're going to have a case where it looks ugly until the attorney does his job and makes the argument. That's our job, is to persuade even a resistant court that here's some good facts that maybe you didn't think about. My time is more than up. Thank you to the court and to counsel.
Thank you both for your arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great
Thank
Tuesday,
you, Barry.
everyone.
Nice to see you again, Mr. Edwards.
Mr. Walsh. Mm-hmm.